Monster Man, Special Episode, Ray Harryhausen, and You. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer, Evan. If you'd like to be like Evan and get your own special episode, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also receive the rewards for all other levels, including all new episodes, and I guess all old episodes, of my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take a look at the gaming inspiration we can find in the myths and religions of the world. So Evan, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Evan has asked me to talk about the monsters of Ray Harryhausen and about rubber monsters in general. And before anyone says anything, I know that Ray Harryhausen's monsters are not rubber per se. Or maybe they are, but I think they're kind of clayish. I've seen some of them up close, actually. There was a display of them in London, and I went there one year as part of my birthday celebrations, and very nice it was too. Somewhere there is a photo of me imitating the pose of the skeleton. In fact, having said that, I once recorded a My Favorite Monster special with the miniature sculptor J.C. Fairclough, and we spent quite a lot of time talking about Ray Harryhausen, but unfortunately, the audio quality was not good enough. The edit didn't quite work out. This was the early days of the podcast, and I never released it. Anyway, Evan writes, "The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and Jason and the Argonauts were regular Saturday afternoon fare when I was a kid, and they cemented my lifelong love of myth, folklore, and fantasy, even if Talos scared the bejesus out of me at the time. So the question is, how do we make this kind of monster work in a tabletop game? Conceptually, I think this is a rather challenging concept, but let's dig into it and see what we can do." So what are we talking about when we talk about the monsters of Ray Harryhausen? For those of you who are coming to gaming outside of its normal cultural context, Ray Harryhausen was an animator, specifically a stop-motion animator. That's the process where you have a model and you move it a tiny amount and then shoot a new frame of film, and then you move it a tiny amount again, and you shoot another frame of film, and then the film plays at 24 frames a second, and it seems as though the creature is moving. It's quite a time-consuming process and requires a lot of fine attention to detail, which, of course, Ray Harryhausen had. Specifically, he called his process dynamation, but what that is other than clever branding, I couldn't tell you. Harryhausen produced a number of memorable movie monsters throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and even into the early 80s. Classic Harryhausen monsters include the creature in The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, as well as 20 Million Miles to Earth, The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, the other two Sinbad films, Jason and the Argonauts, and eventually Clash of the Titans, and many more. Inspired at a young age by King Kong, the classic Willis O'Brien monster, Harryhausen did a lot of kind of naturalistic monsters, so dinosaurs and similar things, the Mysterious Island, there's other like the giant animals, the Valley of Gwangi. He alternates between kind of naturalistic animal-based monsters and more fantastical ones, and it's the more fantastical ones that we're going to be focusing on today. Harryhausen's monsters are very memorable. Even if you've never seen one of these films all the way through, I bet you would recognize at least one of the creatures, and they were very influential on fantasy gaming. So for instance, I would say a lot of games draw their concept of Medusa not from the Medusa of Greek myth, but from Ray Harryhausen's Medusa. Part of this memorable quality is because of Harryhausen's distinctive visual style, but it's very challenging to translate a distinctive visual style into a tabletop game. It's so specifically cinematic. But I think that there are a few things that we can learn from a Harryhausen monster that we can apply to games. Like a lot of creatures, the Harryhausen monster takes its qualities from the limitations of its creation. In the case of these creatures, technical limitations. So let's identify the distinctive qualities of such creatures. First up, Harryhausen creatures are uncanny. The motion of dynamation doesn't look like the motion of a living being. It just doesn't. Now, that's not a bad thing by any means, but I do think that Harryhausen is at his best when he's creating a monster that is meant to be weird or unsettling. The more naturalistic ones are perhaps not quite as memorable. Not that they're bad in any way, but I think the ones that really stuck with people are the ones where this slightly off quality of the movement, the action, the way in which the monster doesn't respond in the same way as the human performers, when that is a feature, not a bug, the monster is more effective. Another thing that reinforces the idea that these creatures are uncanny is that Harryhausen creatures don't communicate, or at least they don't communicate in recognizable ways. Most of them, there are exceptions. This doesn't seem to be something that you get with other kinds of film monsters, right? So if you look at like people in suits, puppets, CG characters, not making them talk is a choice. Like Baby Yoda doesn't talk, but regular Yoda sure does. Those characters talk all the time. Now, I'm not sure if there was some technical reason that would just make dynamating a character speaking too difficult, or if this was just one of Harryhausen's stylistic preferences. But this lack of communication makes Harryhausen's monsters seem sort of enigmatic. That's true of monsters like, you know, the giant crab in the Mysterious Island or whatever. Is it a crab? Anyway, the giant sea life in the Mysterious Island. But I think it's more applicable for creatures that have some element of a human face, because we're entering that idea of the uncanny valley. We are very attuned to, very aware of, the subtle motions and responses of the human face. Well, not everyone is, but it is common. It's widespread. For us to have emotional reactions to the way that faces respond, and to be distressed when they don't respond in the way that we expect. This relates to the idea of the uncanny valley, of creatures that seem very close to human, but not quite human, being more distressing than creatures that are wildly inhuman. Consider Talos, or Talos as they call him, in Jason and the Argonauts, who has this sort of immobile, mask-like face with blank, dead eyes, or the weirdly bestial face of Harryhausen's Medusa. These creatures have an element of humanity, but they're not completely human, and if they did communicate, that would make them feel more relatable, because we think of communication as one of the defining qualities of humanity. So these creatures possess many of the things that we would think of as humanity, but they do not behave in a human way, and that makes them especially creepy. Note that this isn't the same as having an aggressive posture. Talos's slow, implacable gait makes him feel more dangerous than if he were charging around super fast, which he would be in a modern version, right? He's not aggressive. Aggression would be a recognizable emotion that we could understand, even if it was frightening. Another common feature of Harryhausen creatures is that they often represent a twist on established creatures. Now, that isn't always true. For example, Harryhausen's famous animated skeletons are really the definitional animated skeletons, to the point where if you buy miniatures of, you know, skeletal warriors, they will often have ancient Greek or Near Eastern accoutrements, even if the game is typically set in a kind of pseudo-medieval setting, as many fantasy games are. And it doesn't always work. So, for instance, the harpies in Jason and the Argonauts are definitely a variation on the traditional harpy. They're much more kind of gargoyle-like than the bird woman of Greek mythology, but also they're not all that great. But for a lot of the creatures, Harryhausen has added some kind of bestial or inhuman quality. Harryhausen's Cyclops is much more monstrous than I think, you know, most of us envision the Cyclops as just a big fella with one eye. The snake body and monstrous face of Medusa, examples of taking a creature that we expected from Greek mythology and making it a little bit different. Not totally different, but just enough so that the cultural familiarity of the creature is slightly offset. And these variations that Harryhausen introduces are consistent with his overall kind of artistic style, as you can see by taking a look at creatures like Ymir from 20 Million Miles to Earth that aren't inspired by any particular mythology. Obviously, I know that Ymir is a mythological figure, but this is just an alien named Ymir. Is that 20 Million Miles to Earth? Am I getting that right? Harryhausen creatures are also often, although not always, large. This is one of those opportunities that results from a technical limitation. So if you want to demonstrate that your hero is brave and strong and resourceful, two ways to do this are to have them fight a single large monster or have them fight a large number of small monsters. And Harryhausen did both at different times in his career. However, a large number of small monsters presents a much greater technical, time, and budgetary challenge for Dynamation than a single large monster. When a monster animated using the Dynamation process moves, all of the parts of it that are moving, all of the joints, have to be hand-adjusted every time you shoot a frame of film. So if you have two monsters, that means twice as many adjustments, which means that the film is going to take twice as long to shoot. Now consider the skeletons, where there's a whole group of them. Between them, all the skeletons had something like 35 points of articulation moving in each shot, which means that Harryhausen was shooting something like 12 frames or half a second of film each day during the production of that sequence. And obviously you can see bits of it where they're, you know, just keeping as few skeletons in the shot as possible or whatever, because every time you take a skeleton off the screen, you're taking a big bite out of the number of points you have to animate. So given that, it makes a lot more sense to have a single monster than many monsters. Then when it comes to size, consider the alternatives. So let's say that you were making a movie where the monster was a performer in a suit, like in a Godzilla movie. If you're doing that, you have a couple of options. If the monster is the same size as the human actors, or at least roughly the same scale, then you can just put it in the same shot with them. You just have the performer on the same set as the other actors, you film it with the camera, job done. This is the approach taken by a movie like, I don't know, Predator. As impressive as it is, the Predator is nevertheless an actor in a costume, and it can therefore just be on the stage with other actors. But if your monster is huge, you're going to have to shoot twice and combine the footage. If we have a picture of people reacting to Godzilla looming over a building, well, we've got to shoot Godzilla looming, and then we've got to shoot the people, you know, pointing their mouths agape in horror, and then we have to add the two together. Is the word I'm looking for composite them? Let's say that it is. That's more work and more expense, which is why in a Godzilla movie, there's often a people plot and a Godzilla plot, and they don't always cross paths that much. But if you're adding a stop-motion creature to a scene, one of those concerns kind of goes away, because that creature has got to be added to the shot in post-production no matter what, whether the monster is normal people-sized or a million feet high, because the creature is actually a miniature no matter how big it is. So unlike something like Godzilla, it's as much work to make it person-sized as it is to make it colossal. Additionally, the bigger the creature is on the screen, the more chance you have to see the painstakingly hand-sculpted details, so you might as well make it as big as possible. Now, there are lots of exceptions, but many of Harryhausen's monsters are big critters. Okay, so, our archetypal Harryhausen monster is uncanny, enigmatic, a twist on an existing monster, and large. How do we apply that in game? Now, I don't have a coherent strategy here, but I do feel like I have some ideas. This is a bit of a first draft. Your suggestions would be very welcome. Some of these points are easier than others. So to have a monster be enigmatic is very simple. Just don't talk as the creature. This is especially effective if it is a type of monster that feels like it should talk. Again, this goes back to the idea of monsters being monsters and yet somehow having human-like qualities. Everything about Talos screams that he's monstrous, but he has, you know, a face, eyes, nose, a mouth, two arms, two legs, and a head. If he wasn't gigantic, you feel like maybe you'd be able to talk to him, but you can't. Huge is no problem. Just have the monster be big. You get bonus points for this if you then put the monster in an environment where the difference in scale between it and the PCs is important or interesting. Again, to return to Talos, he's on this sort of strip of beach, essentially caught between cliffs that even he can't cross, and the water. So we actually see him at the beginning when he is walking around some of these rocks, which he has to go around to get to the Argonauts. But making the difference in size important, making it both a challenge and an advantage, is a good thing. Even the twist is pretty simple. Just take a familiar monster and give it a weird, bestial, or alien quantity. You know, is this an earth elemental? Maybe it has a strange face carved into its rocky body. Maybe it's a giant and it's overgrown with moss and plants, with long roots trailing from the bottom of its feet. Maybe the dragon's face is uncomfortably human-like, with human-like eyes. All good twists. I think this works especially well in the world of kind of branded D&D, where people have very clear ideas about what a beholder is, and a mind flayer, and a red dragon, and so on. Now, the hardest of these qualities is probably the uncanniness, since the uncanniness of Harryhausen's monsters is all visual. It's to do with the film techniques used to animate them and then combine them with the live-action footage. One way maybe to do this, if you use miniatures in your game, would be by having the monster be something that isn't a miniature, like a toy. Something maybe that has some kind of action feature even. I did this in my previous D&D campaign, where I used as a dragon miniature a dragon toy that I found at a charity shop that would like roar and light up. Alternatively, if you don't use miniatures, if you mainly use tokens or similar, what about having the monster be a miniature? I think there is a three-dimensional quality that is vital to the Harryhausen monster that will best be represented visually at the table. However, I don't think that's the only way to do it. If you are going purely descriptive, you should try to vary up the way you describe the creature as opposed to the way you describe other things. We all have habits of language that we fall into, and there's a couple of things, for instance, that I always say when I'm running fights. I have mostly stopped myself saying, "The blow clatters harmlessly off his armor," which is the thing I say every time someone would have taken damage if it weren't for their high AC. When people ask me how badly injured someone looks, I'm trying to stop saying, "He doesn't look thrilled," which is, again, like a real characteristic thing of me to say. We have these tricks of language, and I would say that overall, most of us have to be on guard against language that mundanifies the fight. The alternative to "he doesn't look thrilled" is if it's actually only a minor amount of damage, or if someone passes a save like to resist fear, I have a tendency to say, "Ah, he's loving it." Again, both of those put the monster in like a relatable position relative to the characters, or to the players, I guess I should say, where I'm attributing relatable emotion to this monster. And that's actually going to go against the uncanniness and the enigmatic quality of a Harryhausen monster. I don't want my players to think, "Oh yeah, I get what this guy's deal is." So yeah, I think if you try to consciously introduce some new language techniques into your descriptions, then I think that can help with the sense that these types of monsters don't fit with the world around them, which is a quality that Harryhausen has. You know, I'm always complaining that representations of Greek myth are often like comforting and familiar, that there's no sort of drama or excitement left in those gods and monsters, but that if they were, you know, quote unquote, properly portrayed, they would seem weird and they would get some of their horror and wonder back. But having said that, Harryhausen actually managed to achieve that as well. He just did it not by like going back to basics and going back to artistic presentations from the Greek world or whatever. He did it by adding a note of his individual creativity to an otherwise stock portrayal of these monsters, making them his own. And I think the technical limitations of what he was doing created artistic constraints that actually mean that there's still something very satisfying about watching Harryhausen monsters in ways that there sort of isn't for, like, I don't know. The Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings is far from the worst offender here. It's just that so many of the really bad examples were inspired by and copying the Jackson Lord of the Rings. And that is the kind of like mushy gray army of a billion CGI baddies, where what's imposing about the enemy is the masked effect. But if you look at any one of them, like, it might be a good drawing, but they're not fun to look at on the screen. Or if they are, you don't get a chance to. I guess the equivalent, you know, the kind of counterpart to a Ray Harryhausen monster is something like a Jim Henson monster, right? Okay, it's not stop motion animation, it's puppetry, but it's another example of a monster type that has a very distinctive visual aesthetic, but that much of what it can do is dictated by the technical limitations of the medium. So the bickering and politicking of the Skeksis in the Dark Crystal, for example, I think is very much a consequence of the fact that they can't necessarily be very imposing physical threats, given the fact that they're just not gonna move all that fast. And that is a consequence of what they physically are. So yeah, I am a big believer in the value of the artistic effects of technical constraints. I think some of these things can be inspirational for tabletop role-playing games, even if a largely visual thing isn't going to translate across very clearly. But I hope that that's provoked some thought in terms of how we present monsters in order to achieve certain effects. So Evan, thank you once again for your support. It means a lot to me. I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you'd like to be like Evan and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge the $5 level. In our next episode, one of our patrons has laid down a challenge, a test of monster skill and inventiveness, and I am not going to turn it down. So I hope that you will join me next week for Monster Roulette, right here on Monster Man. A show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.